Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah! Back after our Shallows podcast. We also have special guest, Ethan Vespi.
That's me.
Yes, it is. And we're here to deliver a special bonus episode this weekend. And that is going to be about The Neon Demon, the newest film from writer-director Nicholas Winding Refn, best known for Drive, infamously known for Only God Forgives. We're going to see how that movie played out. Before we get into that, let me remind everyone to find us. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. We love hearing from you there. You can also find us on thefilmstage.com, where you can post comments on the pages under which these episodes are posted. You can also find us on Twitter at Filmstage Show. Find us on Facebook, The Filmstage Show. That is about it. Ethan, it's been a while since you've been on the podcast.
Yeah, about, I think, the first term of the Bush administration.
Probably. We were totally recording back then.
Yeah, 9/11 hadn't happened yet.
No, it was a simpler, more innocent time in America. Jesus. Okay, well anyway, we're living in a post-Brexit world now, so it's a perfect time to have Ethan back to talk about The Neon Demon. And that is all we're going to be talking about. If you haven't heard the other episode we recorded this weekend, it was on The Shallows with a special two-minute review of Independence Day Resurgence from Bill.
ID5.
ID5, yeah. ID42, IDR...
IDK?
Yeah, IDK, IDR4? I don't know.
I'd be willing to talk about Decker Unclassified if... we're willing to make the time. But
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, okay.
What is that?
This is the fourth season in Tim Heidecker and Greg Turkington's Decker, which is an excellent television program broadcast on Adult Swim, and it ties in with their other show on cinema, At the Cinema. And I think anyone who considers themselves a fan of moving images should just, you know, give it a little look.
What if I'm a fan of moving images but tend to hate Tim Heidecker and that other guy?
Well, I think those two things are just naturally intrinsic, so maybe you should ask yourself if you really like moving images.
Maybe I don't. Maybe the only reason I keep watching movies is to podcast.
Probably.
Because I hate moving images, but I love radio. Who knows? All right, wait, fuck it. Let's just talk about The Neon Demon. This, again, is the newest film from Nicholas Winding Refn. Story by, credit for him. Worked on the screenplay with a couple people, and they are Mary Laws and Polly Stenham. And, yeah, it stars Elle Fanning, Jenna Malone, and a bunch of other people. A bunch of other beautiful, beautiful, terrible people.
Keanu Reeves.
Keanu Reeves does make an appearance, surprisingly enough. Here is the trailer.
I see 20 or 30 girls come in here every day. From small towns. With big dreams. Some girls crack under the pressure. You? You're going to be great. What's it feel like?
So that is the trailer for The Neon Demon. What could, I guess, simply be summed up as the story of Jessie, played by Elle Fanning, who moves to LA in order to become a model, and all of the various Refn-esque consequences that come with such a decision. So, we're here to talk about it. We will start off with our basic ideas and then move into spoilers later on. Ethan, you're our special guest, so why don't you kick us off?
Okay, so the year is 2011, right?
Okay.
Odd future Wolfgang Kill Them All fever is sweeping the nation. It's the summer, you know. You're feeling good. You just finished your freshman year of university, and you hear about this movie called Drive. And, you know, it stars Ryan Gosling as well, who's, you know, at this moment pretty cool because, you know, he'd kind of taken some time off and now he's back and he kind of seems like he's representing this new kind of post-metrosexual masculinity, you know, like good looking, well dressed, but, you know, kind of doing that calm, quiet thing that many people think is, you know, good. Now, let's situate us in 2013. To quote my roommate on Twitter, growing up is called deleting your Odd Future Twitter follow lists. So, you know, you're over Odd Future and you're over Ryan Gosling and Nicholas Winding Refn when this movie called Only God Forgives comes out. And at the same time, you're like, no, I'm not about that, you know, hatefulness. I'm humanist. So you reject this film fervently. Okay. Now, we're in the year 2016. Brexit has passed. Donald Trump is about to become president. And this future looks uncertain.
I was about to say, that is a dark dystopia that you've described that we are currently living in. Yeah.
And it's at a time when you can look at the Neon Demon with all its anti-humanism and whatnot and just say, you know what? I'm down.
Okay.
Great. So,
what you're saying is that our horrible, horrifying present and deeply uncertain future has brought you back to the gorgeous nihilism of Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yes, and I'm sure on a future 20-minute opening monologue on a future episode of the Brett Easton-Ellis podcast, he'll go on and on about how much he loves this movie. At least that went through my mind while watching the film. Maybe
you know
that says
hilarious?
Something about me.
I thought the exact same thing.
Yes, I'm with you there.
For anyone out there in listener land who doesn't listen to the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, you owe it to yourself too, because the man does not give a shit about anything, and he will express some terribly batshit insane opinions very eloquently, and then also somehow get his interview subjects to say some very incendiary bridge burny type things. You should definitely check it out, especially if you want to understand what apparently all three of us went through after seeing the Neon Demon. So let me ask you, you're down for this movie existentially. Did you think it was good?
I thought it was very good, to be honest.
I wasn't sure if you were just like in a, yeah, let's burn down the world mode. Okay, great. Bill Graham, do you agree that this movie is both of our time, beyond our time, and very good?
So, I can't agree with everything that was just said. All that just transpired was woof. Okay. Let me say this. I despised Only God Forgives. I thought it was complete and utter dreck. It was beautiful, but beyond that, it was fantastically boring. I thought it lost its narrative way over and over and over again. It tended to pick it back up, you know, 5-10 minutes later, but it was just a winding fever trip of a film.
A Nicholas Winding Refn fever?
Yes, exactly. I came in, I think Bronson is both his most accessible work and also his best, but I also love Drive as well. I'm on that kind of side of the fence when it comes to this man. This film, it is once again beautiful. I call this his neon trilogy, whether you want to take Drive, this, and Only God Forgives. They're very bright and vibrant and also dark films at the same time. This one, I think the narrative is a lot more focused and intriguing. It explores something that we really haven't seen a lot of films explore, the world of fashion and models and things like this, and how it really kind of works with what Refn does so well, which is focus on the beauty and not necessarily the finer story moments. I think this one in particular, he finds a lot of interesting actors to work with that are really kind of doing something unique, whether it's Jenna Malone or Keanu Reeves. Both of them are excellent throughout this film. My biggest caveat is at times I don't know if Elle Fanning is the perfect person to cast in this role. They cast her as this otherworldly beauty, and I think at times it works, and at other times I'm like, but it's Elle Fanning. I'm like, you know, and I've seen this woman now grow up over the course of several different films and things like that. So it's like, I guess maybe I have an odd relationship with her just as a film goer because of that, but there's something interesting to kind of be said about some of the actresses that he puts inside the film, and how they all kind of tend to blend into each other. The two competing models in particular are just almost exactly the same looking, at least at first blush. I mean, obviously they are two very different looking actresses once you kind of really get into the middle of the film. But at first, when either one of them is talking, you're like, wait, which one's the mean one? And which one's the softer one? There's a sequence in a bathroom where we first get introduced to the other competition, and it's really awkward. I think it's intended to be, but I think it's interesting that I did not know what was going on in this film at that moment. I was just kind of flabbergasted that Refn completely muted out all the score elements and everything else. It's a pretty quiet sequence, and it is them just tearing into her. And I thought it was interesting the way it kind of sets up her character, and then from that point on she's just kind of becomes her own kind of creature and really starts to hold her own in many ways. As far as the narrative overall, I think it's another Refn film that feels a tad bit too long, but I have to say one thing I love about Refn is when he goes for something, he goes for it. And that could be said about Only God Forgives. It could be said about Valhalla Rising. It could be said about any of his various works. And he definitely goes for it in this film. And at first, you're not quite sure if he's actually going to go there. And then he just rams right into it. I was quite surprised by where the film goes, and it definitely kind of lives up to the name of Neon Demon, having kind of that kind of ambiguous name. You're not quite certain what is going to transpire in the film, but I think in a way it kind of lives up to that kind of name. This is definitely a rated R film. This is not something you want to take your mom or your dad or your cousin or, you know, someone like that to. Very hard R.
Legally are able to go see a rated R film.
Maybe, possibly. Depends on how old your parents are, you know. but I don't think you would be taking them at that point if they were that young.
I don't think you would be able to go if they were that young.
You could be like one and they could be like 16.
Okay, Bill, you're speaking of a world in which a one-year-old might take their 16-year-old parents to go see
Neon
Demon.
I'm also speaking about a world where Trump might be the U.S. president.
Let's not think of that.
You know, let's be real.
Oh, my God.
So this film, I think, once again, it finds him collaborating with Cliff Martinez, who's just turning in phenomenal work on the score side. I love his work in this. I love the shots and the scenery. And I found it amusing that Christina Hendricks basically tears into the photography set of the opening sequence. And I was like, I kind of dug that. So I wasn't quite sure who. I'm very curious to see who he got as information and, you know, like experts on these kind of subjects and things like that, because I'm curious if he did, you know, any kind of expert research at all, or if he just winged it, because I feel like Refn, he often ends up sexualizing a lot of things that are kind of weird. Like in this film, I think he sexualizes flash photography. Like every time a flash happened, he really keys in on that moment, and whether it's in the opening sequence or whether it's in some of the nightclub scenes and things like that, he seems kind of mesmerized by the whole notion of flash photography and things like that, and how it kind of changes the viewpoint. But I don't know. This is a long-winded way of basically saying I don't know what the hell is going on in this movie, and yet I came away enjoying myself and can't wait to kind of dig in and watch it again.
So you're voting yes on the referendum?
Damn it! Damn it! Damn you to hell! That was going to be the thing that I said. All right, fine. I guess I'll just jump into it. I think that the director, damn it, you know, you just ruined it, lodges a blistering referendum against modern beauty and the way that we place a premium on it and the way that women are encouraged to compete to win at it. I feel so much less clever now. Anyway, so yes, Ethan Vestby, the referendum, I am a fan. I really like this movie. It is disturbing and beautiful and tense in a way that only Nicholas Winding Refn can really pull off. And I don't even know how to begin to describe what this movie does and how it pulls it off, but you know, Bill, like you were saying, Elle Fanning, I think, in this movie is great. I think that she hits everything you want, though, like you were saying, she's said to have an otherworldly kind of beauty, and she still looks a little too human.
Yeah,
I would say that Bella Heathcote, who plays Gigi, is a little more anti-human, which is hilarious because she's called the Bionic Woman. Because she's had so much work done.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and she's the sort of pleasantly dim-witted of the two other models. There's Sarah, who's played by Abby Lee, who appeared in Mad Max Fury Road.
Yes.
And Gods of Egypt.
And Gods...
Yeah. Oh, shit.
Let us not forget Gods of Egypt.
Don't forget.
No, never forget. Never forget Gods of
G-O-E.
Egypt.
G-O-E. G-O-E.
Oh, God. Anyway, so yeah, she was in Gods of Egypt and Mad Max Fury Road. And she is the more lethal fighting Australian model. And, you know, part of me was like, wouldn't it have been great if we could have made this a couple years ago and had, like, Taylor Swift with her vaguely extraterrestrial look? But Elle Fanning brings a nice humanity to the points at which she still has humanity. And, yeah, I dug the hell out of this movie. You can't discount any movie that allows Jenna Malone to play into her craziest instincts and do something real fucked up. And in addition to that, I mean, it's just gorgeous. And Refn's photography, along with the score work done by Cliff Martinez, is just a combination that you can't denounce in any way. And I actually liked Only God Forgives because I have no soul and I hate people in general. And so the nihilistic concept of that movie really worked out for me. And I actually found a strange morality in that movie. And I find this movie to revel in amorality unchecked by any system of justice a little more than only God forgives did. And I'm down with it. To bring up Bret Easton Ellis again, a man who I think will be brought up synonymously with this movie a number of times. I mean, this is pretty much how I envisioned the book Less Than Zero when I first read it as a college freshman. Lo, those many years ago. You know, beautiful blonde people, people saying things that don't technically have anything to do with the thing that was last said to them. This kind of vapid value placed on physical appearance and stature. And it's just like, if Refn could have done a Easton Ellis adaptation, I think that would have been something super interesting, because they both believe in the call towards a higher morality while admitting that no one is going to go for that of their own volition. And I love that, because I have a super low opinion of humanity as a whole.
In the middle of a competition, and let's make no mistake, you know, the beauty model and things like that, I don't know if it's this cutthroat, but it's, I can definitely understand, because, you know, if you're in any kind of small competition or any kind of local thing, and listen, to no mistake, if you're in LA and you're a supermodel, you're going to see a lot of the same people over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to run less in than small zero, circles. Every single person is like beautiful, tan, tall and blonde. And he keeps describing them as though you're going to be able to notice a difference between them, but it's always some combination of those things. And yeah, I don't know. I found this movie to be both provocative and deeply funny and disturbing and frightening. And I don't think that it's supposed to be a kind of expose. I think it's just supposed to be a satirical, broad-based story. And it, in that way, it wins. And I think people should go out and see it.
I don't think it has the kind of pretensions to like psychological depth that, you know, something like Black Swan has, which is an awful film, but that's what makes this interesting, is that it's essentially just an exercise in style. And that, I mean, also it's interesting that I think his taking his anti-humanism, so to speak, and separating it from kind of a macho world, I think makes it a little more interesting as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, his last couple of films have been soaked in machismo. I mean, from Bronson to Drive to Only God Forgives. And to see him apply that to a different section of the population and yet still be able to keep the venom and the, what's a good word for it?
I thought of a word, but I'm not going to say it.
What is your word?
It was, I'll just say it was more akin to venom, but
yeah. So yeah, no, I dug this film. I know that there are some people out there who thinks that it's, you know, more empty stylishness, and it's a, I know that there was a Vox review that said, you know, oh, a man comes and tries to tell a story about women and fails, but I have to disagree. I feel like from the level that he's coming at, which is basically just turning the volume up on something that we see in our daily lives every day. I mean, he pulls it off, and it's not an expose. It's not a kids level, you know, this is the secret world that you're not aware of. It's very much like, yeah, we all know this is happening. Let me just make it, I won't say fun, but I will say like a carnival mirror.
And let it be said that, you know, obviously he can create these great images of just a pulsating, strobing pyramid set to the Cliff Martinez score going, but also Refn is, I think, dynamic at just shooting scenes of, like, the bathroom scene, four people in a room. Like, he can do that in a master shot. It's not necessarily kind of the Zack Snyder, you know, stunning vista, then handheld close-ups for every scene of people talking kind of directorial mode.
Oh, yeah, no, he
gives
the same attention to everything.
Yeah.
That's why I'm more comfortable calling him, like, a stylist than I would be someone like Zack Snyder.
Ugh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Though Dawn of Justice was a great film.
Let's not get into this. Let's calmly move on. And So do we want to just jump into spoilers, or are there any non-spoilery things that we've still to say about this film?
I will say on Friday night at work, I heard Refn being interviewed on The Queue with Shad, a Canadian interview program on CBC Radio. And I think it's stuff like this in this interview that kind of makes him a target, where it's interesting because you see pictures of him. Every picture of him is the thing where he has his fist held up.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? And I've even seen him in person once, and he's like, you know, a very pompous, like, lively guy. But in this, he's just kind of in this monotone, pompous mode where he's like, I believe all art is about penetration. That's why my art is penetrating, right? And I had a coworker who walked in while he was saying that, went ew out loud. So so I'm sure in December, when Mads Mikkelsen hosts SNL to promote Star Wars Rogue, a part-time Rogue story, he'll do a Refn impression. I can see that. You know, just grill his buddy. You know, give him a little, you know, nice little,
yeah,
rib to the
elbow to the ribs.
Yeah.
Rib to the elbows.
Rib to the elbows. An elbow to the ribs.
Well, I've interviewed Refn twice now, and I've been around him a few times, and he's an interesting guy to just be around. He's both very honest and says a lot of things that you're like, it could be taken multiple different ways. It's kind of interesting because he's almost a living embodiment of his own films, where you're like, oh, that was interesting way of putting things, and then you're like, I don't know if that was good or bad. And so it's interesting being around him, because he's genuinely a nice guy, he seems like it. And he's game for all sorts of goofy questions and things like that. But I think his creative process is super vexing for a lot of other people that aren't around him, or that aren't around him as much. You know, I watched the documentary on Only God Forgives, and it's very apparent that this guy is kind of, he's a fever dream himself while he's directing a film.
Talk a little bit about, you know, we're talking about interviews with Refn, and we actually have one up on the film stage currently.
Mm-hmm. Nick Newman, right?
Nick Newman, who is a common guest of this podcast, got to interview Nicholas Winding Refn, and hilariously, he showed him the tweet that I sent out shortly after this movie. And the short version of this story is that at a certain point during this movie, the tension and anxiety was so much that my wife, who is 9 months pregnant, leaned over to me and said, I think my water just broke. And yeah, the movie basically brought her to a point where her water broke. And Nick Newman showed Refn this tweet that I'd sent out, and Refn just kind of was apparently amused by it, and then said, I have two kids, so I know what it's like.
So you just stayed there and watched the rest of the movie while your wife drove herself to the hospital?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I handed her the keys. She wasn't sure. She wasn't positive. The short version is, for anyone out there who knows how pregnancy works, her membranes had ruptured but had not fully broken. And upon getting to the hospital, they had already repaired themselves and everything was fine. So no,
okay.
I don't have a child yet. That's still in post.
I don't know how bodies work. So.
You don't know how bodies work. It's fine. Yeah. You don't need to at the moment, Bill. So that's, I guess, the best kind of thing you can say about this movie. I mean, this is a recommendation from me. It was so intense that it nearly sent my wife into early labor. And if you're looking for that, then this movie is for you. And if you're not looking for that, go see The Shallows.
Great film.
Great film. Yes. Shallows is wonderful. Just not as tense somehow as in Neon Demon.
And we're going to get into spoilers, right?
Yes, we are now going into spoilers for the Neon Demon. So if you haven't seen the film, get the hell out of here and come back. So spoilers for Neon Demon. What, Ethan, do you believe this movie is trying to say on a macro level, considering that it ends with Elle Fanning being murdered and then devoured by her competitors?
Well, I think it's kind of like a 2001 A Space Odyssey kind of thing, where she's at the end, the Bella Heathcote character is vomiting her out, essentially. So I think it's implying that she will be reborn as another person who, you know, like a kind of a vomit child instead of a star child, who will grow up, and then the cycle will continue. I think that's what it's saying. We're in a vicious circle, vicious cycle.
Now, if that is so, then what are we to make of the fact that Abby Lee eats her eyeball once Bella Heathcote has vomited it up?
I think it's interesting because Elle Fanning makes it very clear throughout the film multiple times that her parents are either dead or just not around or something along those lines. I think it's kind of vague about what's exactly happened to her parents.
So she's been vomited out by a supermodel before, essentially.
Exactly. I think you could definitely read it into this, because I mean this film definitely goes full body horror and just gets crazy, right? So whether it's like praying at the altar of the moon and then like pissing yourself, I don't know what was going on with Jenna Malone, but that was fucking crazy. And yeah, I mean the fact that they even eat her is just absolutely insane. And I guess there's still enough of a body for Jenna Malone to bury her. What was going on with that?
Maybe that's the bones. I don't know. I mean, Jenna Malone bathes in her blood. And joking tone aside, ladies and gentlemen at home, we're being serious. She was murdered and devoured in part. Obviously, there are some remains left to bury. Jenna Malone appears to be laying atop the grave. And yeah, Jenna Malone is praying to the moon and then appears to be bleeding out of her vagina. And Bella Heathcote is like retching and then attempts to cut her out of her own stomach with a pair of scissors, vomited up her eyeball, and then
goes really well.
Eats her eyeball, and then just walks off perfectly fine. So, is the statement perhaps that the world seeks to consume natural beauty for its own ends, and that the attempt to do that will ruin you unless you are some sort of colder, less admiring person? I mean, like, what? Statement, or is this all shock?
Well, I think it's a bit of a little jab at Los Angeles New Agey practices, you know, like bathing in mud or whatever will have you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. I think, in short, what you said is essentially right, but it's something that's more interesting through just the images than what it's saying, which is, again, the movie in short.
Well, right, that's almost always what a movie does.
Let's be honest, though. I mean, we're on this impression, or giving this impression so far, that Elle Fanning is this kind of, a perfect little creature throughout this film. She has some dark turns.
Oh, she gets dark. As soon as she starts to have success, she undergoes a very extreme transformation.
Yeah.
There's a point where... What is it that she says to the guy she's sort of dating? Like, he says, "You really want to be like them?" And she says, "You don't understand, they want to be like me."
Yeah.
Which is... She delivers that line perfectly, by the way.
Yeah, she's really kind of come full circle. She's definitely entranced by the entire experience and things like that. And so she kind of turns on her own kind of self-image that we've kind of built up throughout this film of this, you know, newbie that's fresh and innocent and quickly becomes consumed by this world. And you know, both literally and figuratively, obviously. And I think it's interesting the way that they kind of play on that, because had they not turned her almost into a antagonist halfway through the film, I think it wouldn't be as effective if she was still sweet and innocent, because this would be another typical kind of, you know, death comes to those that are just, you know, not prepared and things like that. But I think she was
to quote Bret Easton Ellis, the victim narrative.
Yes.
He does love the victim narrative. Well, he loves hating the victim narrative. What I would say is that what's interesting about the fact that she turns at some point and becomes a antagonist almost to the other people in the movie, I mean, she leverages some truly terrible things to her advantage, but it's almost like a supervillain who gains power, hasn't yet had a chance to learn how to harness it fully, and is then butchered
cut
by
down.
A bunch of other villains and then consumed by them. It's like they're protecting their alpha status from this proto-alpha who's definitely going to wreck their day.
And my question on the entire narrative, to me, I think everything kind of hinges on one moment, and that's Jenna Malone coming onto her. And I'm very curious if had Jenna Malone been successful, or, you know, Elle Fanning given in to her, I wonder if Jenna would have turned on her the way that she still
I
does.
I don't believe that she would have, because, and again, this goes to that whole people looking to use beauty narrative. I mean, Jenna Malone wants to, in her own very deeply creepy way, love and gain from her beauty just a sensation of self and pleasure, but once she's been denied that, she has no reason to let this thing continue.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then I think, what do we think is the turn for her? Is it that weird golden...
when she starts wearing leather pants?
That's right after the golden photo shoot, correct?
Probably.
No, I think the turn for her is when she becomes first place in that runway show, and she's immediately elevated as soon as she shows up. I think that's kind of the turning point, because it's there in the after party kind of situation, which is, I guess, not really an after. I don't know where the hell they are. They're at like a restaurant or bar or something. They're like in the lobby of a hotel, it almost seems.
Chateau Marmont, maybe.
Possibly. But they're just like hanging out in this bar area. And I guess Elle Fanning just walks right in and brings her friend, introduces him, and then they don't even like sit down at the same table. I was just like, what is the? I don't understand what this fucking situation is. I don't know why the head guy didn't like recognize the fact that he just elevated this girl to, you know, premium status, and is like, oh, well, my other bitchy friends won't make room for you, so go sit over there. You know, and it's like, what? I thought I was your star pupil now. And he's just like, nah. Sit over there. You'll
I think
fine.
That he would want her to sit down, but she just doesn't need to. She realizes that she doesn't have to schmooze, because this... Oh, God, this is a beautiful scene. It's, the fashion designer is played by Alessandro Nivola.
I liked him. Yeah. He was fucking great in just, like, 2 or 3 minutes.
And
When he first sees her... They play that up so well when she's on the runway and he's like cleaning his glasses or something like that. And then he just looks up and he's just got this look on his face like he just saw the face of God or something.
Yeah,
and can we all do an impression of him coming in his pants?
Exactly.
Yeah, they definitely cut out some audio from that, because the look on his face. And in fact, on Twitter, you can now get a gif or a gif, however you want to pronounce that stupid word, of that moment. And it is deeply creepy, and that was a huge laugh moment in the theater, because it is so overwrought, and it's beautiful, but not quite as beautiful as when he has her brought to him right before the fashion show starts and just points at her and he's like, "You're going to be the ending of my show." It's just, it's fantastic. I don't even know how to describe it.
Yeah. A lot of this reminds me of that sequence in Hail Caesar with Ralph Fiennes, where he's giving this young guy the dialogue.
What were so simple?
Yes. And he's just so... He's just giving it his all, and this guy just cannot comprehend what he's supposed to say and do in the situation. And it just reminded me of that moment so much, because I can imagine that half of the audience is just like, what is going on? Why is it taking this turn? And if you're up with the film, if you're into the film, you just can't help but laugh at that moment, because it is everything cliche about the model industry and things like that. And it's something you would just completely expect someone in that position to say to their supermodel, you know, and, you know, whether that is actually true or not, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. In this film, it's played for laughs. And I think it's kind of a good barometer for whether someone is going to enjoy this film or not. Unfortunately, it's like an hour and a half into the film, so by that point, it's probably a little bit too late for you. But it's definitely a sequence where I think it's a good barometer for people if, you know, they're going to enjoy this film or not.
Now, I wanted to ask a question. Do we feel like this movie subverts stereotypical narrative beats that a story like this would go on, or do we feel like it plays into it? Specifically, she has little to no trouble rising in the world as fast as she possibly can. Because, again, in this movie, beauty is basically akin to a superpower. And when she is brought into a situation that seems like, in an after-school special type of scenario, it's heading for a full-on rape scene. And this is when she has the photo shoot where the man says, you know, everybody out, it's a closed set.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has her stripped down and then paints her gold and then actually takes pictures of her. Is that a subversion, or is it merely this movie's own metaphorical take on that scene? Do you feel she maintains agency and power in there, or has she been stripped of it?
I think it's definitely a moment that is potentially a violation of that. I think she's obviously this kind of new and young and innocent person in this world, and I think she's game. But I think she's also, it's tough, because to this point, there's a lot of things going on in that scene. It is potentially her first nude photo shoot. It is potentially the first time that, you know, she's been shot in this way. It's also interesting because we know coming in that she's technically, she just turned 16.
Yes.
And so she is definitely underage, and so we have this older man who's, I don't know, maybe he's 30, 32, somewhere like that. I mean, I'm trying to think how old,
conservatively double her age.
We'll go with that. And it's this potential for this thing. She's 18 right now. It's this potential for this thing where there's a lot of narrative things going on behind the scenes that we're aware of, but, you know, the photographer necessarily isn't. I don't know. There's so much potential there to kind of read into things of what is going on. But I think at its best, this is a woman that has realize that she's been given an opportunity to maybe photograph with, you know, one of the greatest photographers of her age or something like that. I mean, she literally, there's a moment where Christina Hendricks tells her, hey, have you ever heard of this photographer? And she's like, no, and informs her that, you know, it's this great photographer. And then he asks her to strip down naked, and she's just like, okay. You know, and it's just, it's one of those moments where I think it gives her the agency to kind of make that decision. And in a perfect world, maybe there would be more dialogue. Like, well, why is the set being closed? What are we about to do? You know, things like that. But this is a sped up narrative. And I think it, for dramatic purposes, it works. I don't know. I see her having a lot of agency in that moment in particular, but it clearly could have turned on her.
To what you very said, easy. I mean, this movie has 300% more dialogue than Only God Forgives. This mm-hmm. is downright chatty for a Nicholas Winding Refn film.
Sure, sure. Ethan especially Vespi. Compared to a Drive film or something like yeah. that.
Ethan Vespi, what did you think of that scene?
The gold
yeah.
scene? Loved it.
Loved it. Now, what do you think that she... Because there's a disconcerting point of this movie where it's hard to tell if it's an exploitation narrative, or as Bret Easton Ellis would say, a victim narrative, or if she's exercising a power unknowingly, and that is, to an extent, her power. Like, do you fall down on any side of that?
I mean, we talk about this and sort of like, I'll be honest, I don't find it that interesting to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I kind of just come away from the movie being like, it was cool that it looked the way it did and sounded the way it did, but not so much the
so you're
drama
for just
of the film.
The pure aesthetic experience of this.
Pretty much, yes, because I think the film is unapologetically so.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I was talking about how, like, for example, Black Swan or something, that's a terrible film because it thinks it's deep, but it's not. And this, to me, this film only very lightly skirts the surface of these things, but I think it's sort of easy to tell at the end of the day what it's concerned about, and I think that's fine.
All right. Well, I have no more thoughts on this film other than to say that for anyone who is interested, it was the necrophilia scene that nearly sent my wife into labor early, which
of course
is a scene that we haven't even touched on. But if you're listening to this section of the podcast, you ought to know what that is. Jesus, this film. I can't wait to see it again. It is super weird, and it's one of those films that I know I'm going to purchase and then probably wait 6 months to actually take the plastic wrap off of.
Sure.
And then possibly yeah. another 3 to actually watch it again. So that is
that.
Our review of The Neon Demon. It is out in theaters now. Check it out. It's like nothing else you will see at the theaters this year. And that is it for this episode of the Film Stage Show. So, gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next episode. Ethan Vespi.
At a small motel in Los Angeles managed by Keanu Reeves.
Wow, man, we didn't even go into Keanu Reeves.
I did a little bit.
Keanu Reeves at all. I mean, but there's a definite scene with him that's real fucked up. Bill Graham. Why don't you tell us where you can be found online?
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can find me writing for The Film Stage and on FreshFiction.tv.
All right. You can find me on TheFilmStage.com. You can also find me on my personal site, BrianJRowan.com and DearFilm.net. You can find me on Twitter at BrianJRowan, as well as pretty much every other social media site. Follow this show on Twitter at Film Stage Show and Facebook The Film Stage Show. Ladies and gentlemen, that is all for today. Promise this time. Tune in next week.